Coming up next is the Professor James McCanny Science Hour at the Crossroads. Now on shortwave, WWCR, frequency 5.070 at 7 p.m. Eastern on Thursdays, and also on Reality Radio Network Internet at www.realityradionetwork.com on Thursday evenings at 9 p.m. Eastern. And now, once again, here's your host, the Professor.
Good evening, July 24th, 2008. And this week, first of all, I know there's many new listeners that come in every week to the show. Just want to remind you that to get a full understanding of what this radio show is all about, please go back and listen to the archives. I cover a very wide range of topics, and you'll have to go back and listen to archives to get pick up on the many, many different topics. You can find these, of course, on the network and also the Reality Radio Network archives and on my webpage down at the bottom of the main web page, the homepage, jmccsci.com. You will find a link to all years and years of radio archives. Some people go through and systematically listen to all of these, and you'll find that, as I said, these shows are relevant today as they were then. Some of my product items have changed, so you want to consult the sales page for the current listing of items that are for sale. But other than that, the content of those shows is always relevant. On to the first topic. Of course, last week I introduced the SEED project, and when I went out to look for the corn seed, and this was all a result, by the way, of my research into the storm situation this past spring. And as I said, I started to investigate and ask the question, how could we, or what would it take to get back to original agriculture, the kind of agriculture that existed prior to genetically modified organisms, before genetically modified corn and other grains and food and crops? What would it take to get back to that original form of agriculture? And I was shocked and amazed to find out that it is almost impossible. In fact, I found that the seed available for many of the different things we grow is simply not available anymore. And I did find a pocket of corn seed that was available, which was the original non-hybrid, non-genetically modified corn seed that when you grow it, this is the big difference between hybrids, which when you grow it one season, if you tried to take the seeds from the corn plant and plant them, they simply would not grow again. They would grow, but in some kind of a very ugly, something you wouldn't recognize as corn. So anyway, my goal was to find and if there was any original seed corn seed stock left, and when I found it, I found there was such an amazing small amount of it that I purchased it. And this corn, let me explain a little bit how it was developed. I went through this last week, but I'll summarize it again. That the original, there were probably about 20 strains of corn that came out of the Americas back in the early days, and these were raised through the pioneer days. And they were, the different varieties came from down south, up north, depending on the growing season, the growing conditions, etc. But basically, it was related to the original corn species that the indigenous people were raising in the Americas prior to the white man coming. So around, and of course, people who are in agriculture know how to save seeds, how to pick the seeds that they want to enhance. And this is a genetic selective process. And remember that the original corn plant, if you want to call it that, that was maybe thousands and thousands of years ago when the indigenous populations first started to cultivate it and propagate it, the original corn was very small. And so what we see today, these huge ears of corn, is a greatly modified from a genetic enhancement simply by natural selection. That's not genetically modified, what I call Frankenstein corn, where they're mixing in chemicals into the corn seed like Roundup or like synthetic methionine or these kind of chemicals that would be mixed into the seed itself. Those are the genetically modified seeds, that what I call the Frankenstein corn. So anyway, I wanted to find out if there was any of the seed corn that had evolved up to, let's say, the 1940s, before laboratories with test tubes and petri glasses got involved. And I did find some, and there are some very limited places that are actually pursuing this. Some people in universities, some very well-educated people, some people in the organic chicken industry primarily, who have been searching for good sources of feed for their chickens and also other animal stock. So I found this corn seed and I purchased all of it. And the reason I did that was to then sell it and distribute this seed corn to my audience, which is all over the world, of course. And when I did this, I thought to myself, am I totally out of my mind here? Are people going to understand what I'm doing, and am I just wasting my time and effort and funding, etc.? Well, the answer is that I was not wasting my time. The public really understands what I'm doing, and there was a tremendous response. And that response, I'm sure, will continue. Of course, initial response is always, high, and then it kind of tapers off, and it continues into the future as new people come along and want to partake. So I'm moving the sales information on these seeds off to the general sales page. It was at the very top of my homepage. And so probably by the time this show occurs, that will have happened. But I will continue to sell these corn seeds until they're literally all gone. So the response was very positive. I got to say that it confirmed what I was thinking, and the public very much understood this. Now, along with this, you'll have to listen to last week's show to get more detail on this, but I wanted to expand on the thoughts I gave out in last week's show. This week, I want to talk about the ignorance in the seed corn field itself, and in general, along with nurseries, vendors of seeds, commodities people, you name it. What I did then is I did an investigation after I found out how difficult it would be for us to get back to the old agriculture. There were two factors. First of all, finding enough seed to actually propagate the old style of agriculture. Second of all, to find land that was suitable. Because if you go out and, say, took the corn seed that I sent out with the seed offering, if you took that corn and took it to a field in Iowa or many of the other Midwestern states where they grow a lot of corn and put those seeds in the ground, they would do terrible. And the reason is because those fields have been depleted of all nutrition and goodness, so to speak, natural supporting goodness, because of over-farming. Now, a lot of the fertilizers used in modern-day farming to make those tremendous fields of corn, they put a lot of nitrogen fertilizer in, and that depletes the ground. In the old style of farming, they had to rotate crops because corn takes a lot of nitrogen out of the ground. So you had to plant crops that would put nitrogen back into the ground. And there are many crops that they used to use, and it would be a three-year rotation. So you would see corn, and the farm literally rotated fields, and this was part of just agriculture, and it was understood that this is what you had to do. Now farmers will raise corn year after year after year after year, and so the ground is absolutely depleted. So as I said, if you took the corn seeds that I sent out and attempted to raise them on a standard cornfield in Iowa or Nebraska or Kansas or Illinois or Indiana, the main corn-producing states, many in also in Minnesota and Wisconsin, the seeds that I sent out would not do very well, simply because the ground has been totally depleted. So you have to find a good original ground to plant these in. And, you know, you almost have to break new ground or use organic fertilizers. Now, remember that when the white man first came to the east, the eastern United States, and learned how to plant corn, the Indians showed them a little trick. They would take a fish and they would cut the fish into pieces, and they put a little piece of fish under a mound. They would hoe up a mound of dirt, and they put three corn seeds in each mound with a little piece of fish underneath it. And the three corn seeds were for a reason, because they would cross-pollinate. And the Indians probably didn't understand this, but they knew that that's what made a good corn crop. And then they would plant rows of these and plant a cornfield so that the corn would support itself in case of a strong wind or that type of issue. But at any rate, that's how they grew the original corn. And so you might want to try this if you have limited space. Use a natural fish-based fertilizer, not the modern chemical fertilizers, thank you, please, because the seed that was sent out has never been exposed to herbicides and the standard, what you might call modern standard farming. But the reason I sent this out to far and wide and sold it in small packages so that this corn seed stock would get distributed far and wide, and then it would grow under many, many different various conditions, growing conditions, down south, out west, in the southwest, up in the northeast. And the original corn stock would start to actually have slight variations and become stronger in one part of the country. And out of all the seed that goes out, there are going to be people who succeed at growing this, saving the seeds, developing their future stock, transferring this seed back and forth between other groups that have similar seed stock, and this will develop the original corn strains once again in the various parts of the country and in the world. And out of all of this, the hope is that the original corn strains will maintain. Now, as I said, you can get heirloom seeds from certain companies, but there's very, very little of it. Certainly not enough to even plant a good-sized farm. So the goal here was to get what we called back in the 50s seed corn. This is what you fed to the animals. This is what the farmers would go out, and when they saw the best ears of corn coming in, they would set those aside instead of feeding them to the animals. And that would be their seed stock for the next year, always selecting through that just that minimal natural selection process the best corn seeds to plant for the next year. And then they would take some of that and trade. They'd go to church or to community meetings, and a farmer would come in with a sack of corn seed, and he would trade it for another sack of corn feed from some other farmer. And then in this way, you had a mixture of the species of corn, so to speak, slightly altered because of growing conditions, etc., and soil conditions. This is how the modern-day corn came about, up until about 1940, before the agribusinesses got in with the test tubes and petri dishes and made the eventually what I call Frankenstein corn. So now, as I said, I want to talk about a little bit of an investigation that I did, where I went out and I queried nurseries, seed vendors for that deal directly with farmers, and like the home and garden department at major vendors, you know, like that specialize in trees and plants and seed. And I asked them a couple simple questions. Just as a consumer, I'd walk in and say, I see you've got these seeds here. Are they hybrid? And I would try and talk to a manager or someone who they claimed was their seed expert. And this is the kind of answer I would get. Most of our seeds are organic. I said, you don't understand. I'm not asking you if they're organic. I'm asking you if they're hybrid or non-hybrid. They didn't even know what I was asking them. I was shocked and amazed. And I would get an answer, oh, but they're organic. Organic has nothing, absolutely nothing to do with the genetic strain of the seeds. Organic simply means that by some standard, and usually by this time it's very loose standards, that the crops, the seeds, were generated in a field that used organic techniques. The soil had been it had not used chemicals or herbicides. That's one of the issues. But now, with the way congressional law reads, you can use human waste and radiate using nuclear waste and still call it organic. So what is organic really? It's a very loose definition, but the point is the actual genetic strain in the seed is related to what's happened to that seed. Where did it come from? Is it from a bio lab? Is it from a company that grows a huge field of corn strictly for seed, but it's a hybrid and it will only grow 1 year and that's the end of it? And now almost all plants that you will find have some type of genetic modification, whether they're fruit or vegetables or watermelon. You get watermelons now. I'm appalled at these watermelons with no seeds. They don't have seeds, but they don't even taste like a watermelon. Not the old-fashioned kind. When you got a watermelon, like when I was a kid, you cut that thing open, it tasted, there was a flavor to it. And now the new ones with no seeds, to me, you may as well just drink a glass of water because there's no flavor in it at all. Let's take something like blueberries. Blueberries have been enhanced to grow commercially, and you get these giant blueberries, same with strawberries, raspberries. You see these giant fruits in the wild. Blueberries are a very small berry. Strawberries are very small. I was out in the woods one day and I picked some wild strawberries and I gave them to a person, and that person looked at it and said, what's that? I said, it's a wild strawberry, eat it. And I had a hard time convincing that person that they should actually eat a wild strawberry picked out of the woods, because it didn't look like one of those giant red things that you buy in the store. So the original genetic strains of wild fruits, vegetables, all of these tend to be smaller with a lot more flavor. But the point is that the people who are selling seeds and plants today in the nurseries, seed houses, etc., have no idea what they're selling. So then I started to call up places that were selling seeds for other purposes, for sprouting, for this, for that. And I asked them, I said, are your seeds hybrid? And they said, well, they're grown for sprouting. And I said, well, are they, the genetic strain of the seed, are they hybrids? And then many times I would get the answer, oh, well, all of our stuff is organic. And I'm like, this just drove me crazy because of the lack of knowledge, the lack of understanding. And these are the seed experts in the stores selling to the public. I'm made a comment last week about the Asian people who come to the United States, and farming was a way of life over there, so they've continued that here, and they grow wonderful gardens, and they go out and buy seed and they plant, but little do they know that what they are planting is hybrid, genetically altered plants, whether it's leeks or cabbage or berries or corn or right, you go right down the line. What they don't understand is when they buy that packet of seeds to plant, that generally is a hybrid seed and it will not grow the next year. And of course, where they came from, there was no such thing as the seed store. So I just want to emphasize that when people go around and say you purchased some of the seeds and you went to the seed store and you talked to the guy about the seeds you bought, chances are they would have no idea what you're talking about. And I actually got some negative reactions from some of the nurseries that I went to, because I then finally one of the managers came up and I was talking to him, and I said, do you know what hybrid is? And he's like, no. I said, well, that's a seed. I said, a non-hybrid seed is one that you can plant, and it will generate the fruit or whatever, and the seeds you can take and plant the next year. And it was like he was angry because someone would buy just one set of seeds and they wouldn't ever have to buy seeds from him anymore. So he actually didn't like the idea of selling a type of seed where you would not have to buy it every year from him. So I got all kinds of reactions, but least the I did not find very many people. I found a few people who had a long history in the seed business that really knew what I was talking about, what I was asking for. So at any rate, just wanted to extend last week's show and also confirm that people out there do understand what I'm talking about, but you are in the minority. You're going to learn things, and as I said many times, you're going to learn things on this show that you are not going to hear anyplace else. And if I know there are other good talk show hosts covering a topic, I tend not to cover it here. But this seed topic was one that just hit me in the face. And as I said, I started investigating all of this when the floods began occurring this spring in Iowa, as the farmland went under, as we realized that the farmland would, a lot of it, up to 5 million acres, would no longer be tillable, that would probably never be able to raise crops again, or at most it would be able to raise the Frankenstein crops based on genetically modified seeds and fertilizers. I read a story last week how the nitrogen has destroyed the Gulf of Mexico. There's an area the size of the state of New Jersey at the base of the Mississippi River that is dead. It's called the dead zone because of the nitrogen that's coming down the river from Iowa, from the Midwestern corn states. All that water flows down to the Mississippi River and it's full of nitrogen. It's killing the fish life in the Gulf of Mexico. So we are literally, with bad farming practices, with agribusiness, with Frankenstein plant products and seed products, killing this planet. And it's not fit to eat. There are chemicals in there, but this is for the majority of the world's population. This is all that's going to be available. At any rate, on to the next topic. I was out the other night looking at Jupiter. And for anybody in the northern hemisphere or the southern hemisphere, if you're in the southern hemisphere, you would be looking north. If you're in the northern hemisphere, you would be looking towards the south. But the brightest thing in the night sky this summer is the planet Jupiter. So I would encourage you to go out and take a look at it. It's and this is what struck me as I was out with my binoculars. I was looking at Jupiter. And you don't really need a very powerful set of binoculars to see the four moons. And so it'd be kind of fun as a family, take the kids out, this type of, an outing, get out in the country away from city lights, or if you go camping, to, and by the way, August is coming up, and that is aurora month. So possibly in the northern states, you'll be able to get out away from city lights and see some good auroras. We do have some good solar storms going on, and I noticed this past week we did have some auroral activity, so keep tuned to that. But back to Jupiter. The four moons of Jupiter, called the Galilean moons, of course, were discovered by Galileo when he made his first small telescope. And he ground the lenses and made a telescope, and discovered that there were four moons revolving around the planet Jupiter. And, of course, this led to the idea that things would orbit another planet. Now, as I was watching Jupiter myself through the binoculars and observing the moons, and they stick out quite far from Jupiter, the white little dots all in a line sideways coming off the central equatorial plane of Jupiter. What struck me is just imagine the ancients looking at the night sky, and of course they spent a lot of time looking at the night sky. And then it occurred to me what minimal optical enhancement you would need to observe the moons of Jupiter. And of course, if those ancients had observed the moons of Jupiter, they certainly would have named them as they named everything else that was prominent in the sky. So the fact that we have many civilizations, take for example the Maya, do not have names for the moons of Jupiter, which would imply that they in fact were not, they did not have even minimal optical enhancement. They didn't understand the principle, and they did not have these. So it's one of those little things in history that you can look and see what civilizations may have or may not have had optical enhancement, because the moons of Jupiter would have been one of the very first things that they would have noticed. So, as I said, go out, take the kids out to the country, go camping, take a pair of binoculars, and just look up in the southern sky from any time after sundown to about 2 in the morning. You'll see that big bright spot up in the sky. That's Jupiter. Take a look at it. And the moons change positions on every night because they're in orbit around Jupiter. And they change positions. So on every different night, you'll see the moons in a slightly different spot. And if you had good enough magnification, if you had a small telescope, then you could see the moons actually coming in front of Jupiter and going behind Jupiter. And therefore, for example, with Galileo, he could tell that they were actually in orbit around Jupiter. So, just a fun summer project, but also with a little bit of insight into our ancient ancestral occupants of this planet, that they did not have optical enhancement, even a minimal amount. And there are many ways that you could make lenses. Making lenses and mirrors is not a difficult task. Coating it with something so you could get at least a minimal amount of optical enhancement. So it's interesting to see all of the civilizations that did not have optical enhancement, because at minimum they would have observed the moons of Jupiter. Just a couple quick notes here. This past week I had a meeting with a good friend of mine. His name is John Moore. He's a talk show host on Republic Radio, and we sat down and had a discussion about many topics. But at the end, John was telling me that on his radio show, he has all but closed out all topics of discussion, and his main focus these days is on the economic collapse of the United States, which we are all watching somewhat in amazement. But for the, you know, those of us who've been in this field for a long time, it's very clear that this collapse is man-made, and it was very much almost predicted. Jefferson, I believe, is the one who said that if you allow foreign bankers with interest into your country, that they will, through inflation and deflation, take over all of the lands of the property without lifting a finger, and your children will not be able to buy the homes or own the property in your land. And, of course, they knew when they started the United States that the bankers were out there. They knew what their tactics were. They'd move in, create phony money, create phony wars, phony taxation. And this is what the United States was founded to get away from. And you find that when the public education went in around the same time as the Federal Reserve banking system went into this country, around 1913, that there was a bit of control and elimination of certain parts of our heritage that they were just eliminated from the textbooks. And other things like the Great Flood, for example, is no longer taught. So when kids go to school in the public school system primarily, they don't learn the basic, they don't have a basic understanding of what our Constitution was all about. The Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, was all about something very special. It's called getting rid of the federal government or any kind of government that is overbearing and leeching off of the hard labors of the public. Now, the system of interest on money was actually, and I've talked about this at length, I'm just going to go through a little bit on this this radio show, and as I said, many of these topics are being talked about extensively on other radio shows, so I'm not going to go into a great amount of coverage on this particular show. I have done entire shows in the past that cover these topics and what has to be done, the extensive amount of changing that has to be done to get back to our original constitutional government and banking system. But at any rate, it's something that I call the impossible dream. Remember Cervantes, a book called Don Quixote, and they made a musical out of it. The man from La Mancha is the musical. I believe it was made into a movie, and it was, of course, a long-carrying Broadway hit. But the impossible dream, Don Quixote was kind of an idealist. And everything he saw through Don Quixote's eyes. Well, that's kind of like the American public now, who are, in fact, looking through a set of glasses that are very distorted. And right now, I would say the vast majority of people have no idea what is happening to them, why it's happening, what the history is of all of that goes back to this is a long-planned event. And not only that, but moreover, that these events have happened many times in the past. We've watched as these banking systems have gone into third-world countries, basically taken over the resources of the country, enslaved the people so they were working at absolute dirt wages, and they became slaves, essentially, for the money masters, simply who created money out of thin air. Now it's happening to the United States, which is on its road to becoming third world status. What's a third world? It's a country where there's a vast division between rich and poor. The rich, 2-3% of the population, own 95% of the wealth. And the rest of the population owns the other 3% or 4% of the wealth, and there is no middle class. And these countries got that way for a reason. Usually they were set up under monarchies, which brought that system in with them. Our country was very different in that we actually began where all men were created equal. You all had an equal opportunity to advance. It didn't guarantee you would advance, but it gave you the opportunity. In that sense, everyone was created equal. Well, now we are on the verge of being tossed into this same third world country status where the impossible dream is coming true. And that is, just take a simple example. If someone comes in, creates completely phony money, loans it to you and then demands interest on that phony money, there's a simple fact. There's simply not enough money to pay back the interest. There's a question that someone asked me this past week, very innocently, that she knew bankers and they were very nice people, and she wanted to know if they knew about all of this and if they were in on the inside scam. And I said, actually, I know a lot of bankers too, and they don't have a clue. They're like a lot of people. They go about their daily job, and they are simply clueless. They have no idea because they were raised in the United States, where the true meaning of the Constitution of the United States and the Bill of Rights and the Declaration of Independence, they were all of the true meaning for those simple little documents. All of the true meaning has been removed from society. So are they guilty? Is ignorance of the law, would you be found guilty if you didn't know what the law was? Well, it's hard to say. But the basic situation is most bankers simply don't have a clue and haven't taken the time to understand that as they loaned out money, as they borrowed money at 2, 3, 4% from the Federal Reserve and loaned it out at 7 or 8 or 9%, that they were taking part in the destruction of this country. The impossible dream was taking place, and they were part of it. Interest on phony money, the taxes that don't even pay a fraction of the interest, the annual interest on the national debt. And who's the guy that is so wealthy he can loan money to every country in the world? I'd like to meet that guy. Actually, I've met some of them in my life. And they don't work very hard, but they all, you know, they go around and they manage their money. This is what they do. And their kids grow up managing their money, and they basically run the politics of the world, run the industry of the world, and also when it comes time for the population of the world to go under, they are the ones that take all of the money. As I said, all of the money that has been lost in these bad investments, things like that, that money is not lost. It goes somewhere. It's just not in your pocket. Deficit spending with interest to political favors. Military spending, which is basically a black hole. Now, Cheney made a statement a number of months ago. Somebody asked him about the economy. He said, I don't know what you're talking about. I see the economy running great. It's running great on all eight cylinders. That was his quote. Well, what he means is that on the national credit card, all of the money is going into the pockets of his buddies, and you are being left with the bill. And for most of this, the bill has not hit yet. For the war in Iraq, you have to understand that the vast majority of spending has actually been on the credit card. So as with any credit card debt, the bill has not come in yet. And the failure of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, Bear Stearns, and all the other mortgage companies, this leads up to the point of this. And as I said, many people are talking about this topic, the failure of the U.S. economy. But the point is that in the next month or two, many small banks will begin to fail, primarily because they hold the paper for construction loans that are not that are due but unfulfilled. So these construction loans, which many of the small banks are holding, simply aren't going to come through. The banks will fail, and they were loaning out probably 20 times the amount of money that they actually hold. So guess who's going to get their money first, and guess who's going to get their money last? Another little issue that I heard, and this seems to be viable, that the Federal Reserve is bailing out the large investors, Freddie, that invest in the mortgage companies that are failing. But the question is, are they going to back up the failing FDIC, the outfit that backs up to $100,000 in every savings account? It is estimated that about a sixth of the FDIC funding has been taken up by the IndyMac failure in California alone. So it doesn't take too much of a rocket scientist to find out, to figure out that the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, would fail almost overnight as these small banks start going under and people start making claims to their money. So at any rate, I've also heard that Congress just passed a law that will prevent small investors from moving their money offshore. It's called Keep the Money Here Act. But isn't it interesting? They let all of the big investors move all of their money offshore first. So it's just the little guy, once again, who's going to take it, you know where. And so at any rate, all I'm saying, I'm not a financial advisor. I can't tell you how to handle your particular economic situation. But when I talk about surviving the future, the thing that will take you through the future is your own source of food, fresh water, and basics. And I encourage people also to plan for their future where there simply is not the infrastructure that we see today. At any rate, it's a matter of personal planning. And once again, I'd encourage you to listen to shows like John Moore and some of the other good shows around that are going to give you a little more information on financial planning. But the reason that's important for me to mention on this show is it ties in somewhat with the seed project I'm undergoing with the corn seed to distribute it so that corn has a future. There are many forces at work in the world today. The big agribusinesses want to harbor that corn genetics stock. They don't want you to get it. They want the population to be absolutely subjugated. And now here's a point regarding the corn experiment that I want to bring up. I've been talking, of course, I talk to people offline, and it's very informative to get feedback. This has to do with a little experiment that occurred back in the 1940s. And unfortunately, I don't have my notes in front of me right now. But I'll post this on the webpage for when I get my notes. They're in a different part of the office here. But at any rate, here's what happened in around 1940. A Quaker took 1 cubic inch of wheat seeds. And now think of the corn experiment that I'm doing where people bought either 200 seeds or 2,000 seeds or 5,000 seeds. Those were the options. So this Quaker took 1 cubic inch of wheat seeds. Now wheat is a little bit different example because wheat is a self-pollinating plant. Corn is a little different because you need cross-pollination between adjacent corn plants. But essentially, the numbers game still works out the same, the example that I'm going to give you. So anyway, this Quaker took 1 cubic inch of wheat seeds, and in that cubic inch were 360 seeds. They planted it the first year and reaped the harvest, which was, of course, rather small. And they took the seeds from that harvest and kept them through and planted them the next year. They took the harvest from the second year and once again were meticulously careful to save all the seeds. In fact, I understand that women were going around on the ground picking up the seeds that fell just to make sure that they got every seed from these first couple years. By the sixth year, they had 75,000 bushels of wheat, and if they would have tried to plant that wheat, there wouldn't have been enough tillable soil in the entire United States to plant that wheat. This gives you somewhat of a vision of the multiplication of loaves and fishes, so to speak, but it's not miraculous. This is simply the numbers game. And I heard an example like this one time also, that if you took a single oak tree and it were the only oak tree left on the earth, and in 50 years, if there were no other competing plants, the entire earth would be covered with oak trees growing, because that was the rate of multiplication of the seeds. So the point is, when I sent these seeds out, even 200 seeds to a given person, if they propagate and do well and save those seeds to the next year and then grow once again, now you will look on a good corn husk, you will see possibly 100 or more seeds on that corn husk. So your multiplication factor is a factor of 100, then times 100 again, times 100 again. In 3 or 4 years, you're going to have all the corn you can eat, plus seed stock, plus enough to give away. That was the logistics of what I was doing. Plus, as I said before, that now this seed strain would be in small pockets all over the place, growing under different conditions, natural selection, growing under warm, humid conditions, under hot, dry conditions, under cold, short-growing conditions, short-growing season conditions, etc. So the corn that I sent out that was from the original pre-genetically modified corn stock, that it would then go to all of these different places and eventually it would come back into play. And I also said that if there were ever a catastrophe, either man-made or natural catastrophe, that the hybrid corn would only last one season and then it would die off and go away. And in the instructions with the corn seed was sent out instructions how to keep your pure corn seed away from hybrids so it does not cross-pollinate with the hybrid, which would destroy the genetic strain. But any of that will become weak and die off eventually. It's the pure strain, the people that do a good job of keeping it pure, that will keep this corn going for posterity. So at any rate, the point is that the game of numbers. So say someone only bought 200 seeds. Then the next year, guess what? They would have 20,000 seeds, and they would actually have enough to plant and harvest to eat, keep the better seed to plant, give some seed away or trade the seed with someone that has like genetically stable seed, and eventually in the world this will become the only corn source, ultimately defeating the goals of the large agribusinesses, if you see what I mean. So there was a logic to what I was doing. There was a numbers game, but I just wanted to reiterate this. Quaker in 1940, who took 1 cubic inch of wheat seeds, 360 wheat seeds, after 6 growing seasons had 75,000 bushels of wheat, so much that they could not possibly even plant it if you used the entire United States as a planting base. But I guess also this became famous, this issue with the wheat, because Henry Ford got involved and actually donated the harvesting machines to harvest the crops because they had so much. But at any rate, I think that's a fun story, but also a very significant one, so you understand that even with 200 seeds, you have the basis right there to generate the future corn crop of the world on into the next century, the next 1,000 years, even in spite of the vast efforts of agricultural businesses. So at any rate, the next topic dealing with the 2008 solar system, the solar wind, and my predictions for severe weather. Now, every year, the National Weather Service, the National Hurricane Prediction Center, puts out severe predictions. This is going to be a bumper crop year, and then as the season goes on, they modify that. But, of course, that's good for business because it drives up oil prices based on that speculation. it never has to come true. And I actually mentioned this last week when I talked about the Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, making a proposition that they were going to punish anybody saying bad things about the stock market, when in fact their job was to punish people who were saying too many good things and selling stocks that weren't warranted. So now they've reversed roles, and they're going to punish anybody who says something bad about the stock market. But at any rate, NOAA is somewhat the same way. They get in the act by making a prediction that this year is going to be a bumper crop of hurricanes. And then all of a sudden, the oil speculators go, gee, well, that is not going to drive up oil prices. So they raise oil prices two or three notches just out of speculation that there might be some hurricanes. But in fact, when I looked at the 2008 hurricane season, I said that unless we have major solar storms, which we don't seem to really be having this year, we had a bit of activity this past week, and a small storm, I think, was it Bertha? The one that went through the Caribbean and went over to into southern Texas. But the 2008 hurricane season, according to my reckoning, was once again going to be a very weak one. So every year since Katrina, a number of years ago, which was, of course, a bumper crop year for hurricanes, but, of course, NOAA didn't factor in the idea that many of those storms were manipulated. They were man-made, so the 25 storms of that bumper crop season were actually, many of them, manipulated. And man-made, man-caused, man-enhanced, whatever you want to call that, using the laser satellites. And I've talked about this many times. I've talked about it in my weather book that is, of course, available on the webpage. But as I looked at the 2008 hurricane season back early in the year, there was very little activity, and August found the Earth sitting almost by itself, very few planetary alignments. In fact, our other good friends, Mercury, Venus, and Mars, which are on the inner solar system, were, in fact, on the very far side of the solar system. And I noted that probably Mars, around the August 9th time frame, and for about the next 2 weeks, we could expect to see severe dust storms on Mars. The reason being that Mercury and Venus have a perfect electrical alignment on August 9th, and then Mercury, of course, very quickly moves out of the way. But that extended electrical connection that would extend far across the solar system between Venus and Mars would last for the next couple of weeks. So I said if you were a Martian, you would expect the time from about August 19th to about August 24th, somewhere in that time frame, about a 15-day period, when Mars would experience severe dust storms, wind storms, possibly even a visible hurricane from Earth. Visible from Earth, that is. The Hubble Space Telescope actually has taken pictures of hurricanes on Mars, but, of course, that's interesting because Mars doesn't have any water, at least at this time. But where is Earth in all of this? Well, Earth is on the other side of the solar system from all of this alignment activity, all by itself. Although we are in the August return current sheet, and the new moon for August is coming up on August 1st, very early in the month. So, all in all, it does not look like we are in for any kind of serious solar system weather, unless, as I said, this past Tuesday, we did have some fluctuating solar activity, which caused some severe storm activity around the equatorial belt of Earth, but it was not major. It was the kind of activity you would expect somewhat this time of year, but no major storms at that time. So at any rate, the next time when we would expect possible severe weather would be on October 6th, relatively late in the hurricane season, and that is when little Mercury and Earth have an alignment. But this is very late in the season. We are probably, by then, we will be out of the August return current sheet and well on our way out of the hurricane season. So, as I said, in spite of the NOAA prediction, the National Weather Service or the National Hurricane Prediction Service prediction, that we would have a bumper crop or higher than average crop of hurricanes. But remember, they also classify the storms, and any time the wind blows, they can call it a tropical storm and make their statistics look good. And I just want to reiterate, when I make predictions, I talk about specific dates and specific reasons for the weather. The Weather Service, the National Weather Service, on the other hand, takes the Las Vegas approach, where they make a number prediction for the entire year. So whether those hurricanes occurred early or late or in the middle of the season, it doesn't matter to them. They just take a tally over the entire season. And as the season goes on, if they're a little low on storm activity, they can count more storms than normal. If they're a little high, then some of those big storms just don't get counted. So they kind of make their own success, if you want to call it that. It's like the weatherman saying, there's a 50% chance of rain tomorrow. And if it rains, he was right. And if it doesn't rain, he was right. It's somewhat the same deal. It's like trying to predict, I call it the Las Vegas technique, because in Las Vegas, if you were to predict the winnings of a certain gambling casino, you could, over the course of the year, because of the way the odds and the cards and the betting is set up, that the casino is going to make so much money based on the number of people that are expected to be there and the gambling odds. Well, it's simply a matter of odds, the way the casinos run. And it's the same situation with NOAA and the National Weather Service. When they make a prediction, it's based on extrapolation from past years into the future, and also it's based on what they consider possibly the El Nino or La Nina, which actually have absolutely nothing to do with the weather. They may talk about salt content or certain ocean current that might be active in the area at the time, which once again has absolutely nothing to do with hurricane development. It all has to do with extraplanetary conditions. The electrical conditions in the environment, our external environment in the solar system. As I said, this past week we had some solar flaring activity, which enhanced weather around the world. We saw some active weather across the central United States and the small tropical storms moving into southern Texas. About 64, 68 knot winds, certainly not what you would call hurricane force winds, but still active storm, tropical storm activity, which is normal for this time of year. But in general, 2008, I do not expect to be a major hurricane year, unless, of course, we see major solar conditions, a comet come in which actively detonates something on the sun, or if we get more man-manipulated storm activity, which we really haven't seen for a couple years. Once again, I'm out of time. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.